I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is author Dennis Lehane. He's joined in conversation by film noir expert and writer Eddie Muller. And now, join Litquake's Jack Bulwar on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Dennis Lehane and Eddie Muller.
Thank you, everybody. I'm Jack Bulwar. I'm the co-founder of the Litquake Festival. We're very happy that all of you came tonight to From Hardback to Hollywood, the expansive career of Dennis Lehane. He has had the kind of career most authors would kill for. Already riding high with a string of New York Times bestsellers, he found his door being knocked upon by Hollywood producers. So in the last 15 years, the name Dennis Lehane has been attached to some of America's most highly regarded films and directors, including Mystic River, directed by Clint Eastwood, Gone Baby Gone, directed by Ben Affleck, Shutter Island, directed by Martin Scorsese, HBO's The Wire, created by David Simon, Boardwalk Empire, directed by Terrence Winter, and The Drop, directed by Michael Roskam. Dennis Lehane grew up in the Dorchester section of Boston, where he has served on the board of trustees of the Boston Library. He has published 10 novels and numerous screenplays and short stories. He lives in Boston and Los Angeles with his family, and we're very lucky to be able to host him here tonight. Dennis will be in conversation with Mr. Eddie Muller, San Francisco's czar of noir and head of the Film Noir Foundation. He is the author of several nonfiction studies of the noir genre and has also programmed and hosted the Summer of Darkness series on Turner Classic Movies. So please give a huge Litquake and JCCSF welcome to Eddie Muller and Dennis Lehane. Thank you.
Good evening. How you doing, Dennis?
I'm good. How are you?
I am very well. Okay. Before we get into your phenomenal success,
yes,
which continues to this very day, mere hours ago when it was released by Variety that Dennis's next novel has already been purchased by DreamWorks. The film rights have already been purchased by DreamWorks. And the book isn't even done. It's not even done.
That's how you pimp people. That's how you get it. That's how you get it done.
But I always like hearing you tell stories about your parents and you know where you came from and your very working class roots and how unimpressed, especially your dad, was with your career choice and all your success.
My dad liked my career choice. He didn't understand it. He didn't quite get it. My dad didn't read fiction. He didn't like fiction. He didn't like movies. He slept through all three of my films. He did. It was pretty cool. He tried to lie. My father was a world-class liar. And he woke up after Mystic River at the premiere, and I said, "What'd you think?" And he said, "Your mother said it was dark." And and then Gone Baby Gone, doing this. And I said, "What'd you think?" And he said, "Well, your mother said they swore too much in that movie." And then Shutter Island, he was like, "Your mother didn't know what the hell to make of that one." But my father's point was, which I really respected, was that, I said to him once, I caught him, he was telling people at a cocktail party, he was like, "Oh, Mystic River, that's my favorite." And I'm like, "You never read anything." And I said to him after, I said, "You ever think you'll, crack like a page in one of the books?" And he says, "Your brother works in a prison, right?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Do you expect me to go to the prison?" I said, "No." There you go. There's your answer. So, yeah, but he was really proud. I mean, he got, in the end, he kind of got what I did. He saw a billboard with me on it. And that kind of, that's when he stopped. He used to call me every time the post office was having an exam. And he did. I had 5 books by that point. I had my own house, and there'd be the old man. He'd call me up. You know, I hear Boston Gas is hiring. That was the key, getting a utility. So, yeah, but in the end, he kind of, when he saw that billboard, he was like, you seem to be doing okay. I was like, I think I'm doing all right, Dad. He was like, okay. So that was it. Yeah.
And you kind of, I'm not going to say stumbled into a career as a writer, but I mean, we're here.
I stumbled into this type of career, I would say.
Yeah. And it was interesting because you sort of didn't grow up thinking that this was.
No, I had these weird zigs and zags. So the first 20 years of my life, I didn't think I could be a writer because it wasn't done. Nobody did it where I came from. Dorchester had this weird renaissance where I grew up. Had this weird renaissance that I sort of became part of, which was then me and a band came named Letters to Cleo and the Wahlbergs all came out of Dorchester around the same time. But prior to that, all we had was Donna Summer and Bobby Brown. So, you know, we weren't like running to claim Bobby, really. And everybody was claiming Donna Summer. So Donna Summer actually said that she grew up in Roxbury when, in fact, she grew up in Dorchester. But so there was nobody out of Dorchester. So we had no models. We had no sense of, oh, this is possible. And I didn't know anybody who became a writer or an actor or anything. My father's highest aspiration for me was that I get a job with a utility. So, but after, and this is the artist, this is the story for a lot of artists, I had the wonderful gift of just sucking at everything else. There was nothing else I was good at. And I tried really hard, and I dropped out of 2 colleges and with safety majors. And then I said, I can't do this. I can't do anything else. The only thing I'm good at is making stuff up. That's pretty much it. That end of list for my qualities. So I said, I'll give it a shot. And that's how I ended up here. And then my second shift was, once I went into study writing, I was an extreme. I thought I was going to be a short story writer. That was my dream. And I was an extremely avant-garde, very literary short story writer. And then one day, when I was about 25 or 26, it was this wonderful phrase. I think it was Mary Gateskill who said it, but I could be wrong. I suddenly grew tired of literary fiction, of American literary fiction, because it seemed to me, not literature, literary fiction, it's its own subgenre, because I agreed with the assessment that it suddenly was only about the vaguely dissatisfied in Connecticut. And I just didn't give a shit. So, and then that led me to sort of say, I really, what I understood finally, I read an interview with one of the few he gave with Cormac McCarthy, and he said he was only concerned with fiction of mortal event. And that's when I went, that's my thing too. That's what I'm not Cormac McCarthy, but it's the thing I care about. I can't write the small domestic kitchen sink kind of story. Mm-hmm. I'm not good at it. So ultimately, you got to play to your strengths. I wish I could. I wish I could do satire too, but I can't. So I couldn't write The Golden Bowl mm-hmm. because I read The Golden Bowl. And I spent the entire book going, you're rich, just buy another bowl. like, the subtleties were lost on me. So.
let's discuss that for a moment. Because you are, you know, I would say you are a very generous writer. In the sense that I know exactly what you're talking about. And if you want to discuss that distinction between literature and literary fiction, please do. But do you think that's why you've been as successful as you've been with the books? Because they are big, generous, you know, you're a storyteller. That's what you do. You know,
right.
There's big emotions, there's strong characters, and you're not afraid to tell a story.
No, I don't think the writers I love, and everybody in the genre, out of the genre, writers I love are writers who are when they miss big. Mm-hmm. They fall from high tightropes. You know, have you ever read, bad Gabriel Garcia Marquez? It's not pretty. It really isn't. But great Gabriel Garcia Marquez is the greatest literature, in my opinion, that I've ever read. The same with Toni Morrison. When Toni Morrison misses, boy, does she miss. James Ellroy. When James Ellroy misses, you can feel it, the wind going through your hair. But I love
you're
that.
You're scraping the remains off the pavement.
But yes. I love that because when you hit, you go, oh, you get A Black Dahlia, you get 100 Years of Solitude, you get Sulla. So that's the kind of writing I engage with, so that's the kind of writing I do. And when I miss, boy, do I miss. It's egg all over my face. But it's kind of it's a tightrope, and it's fun. And it's the biggest thing that when I sit around with writers who treat this, I don't fit in either camp, which is really good, which I think is good to be a writer. I don't fit in any camp, really. I don't fit in the literary world because I don't write about golden bowls. And I don't fit in, I think, the sort of commercial world because I just don't really care about commercial prospects when I write. And sometimes when I'm sitting around with the commercial practitioners, I feel like I'm sitting around with bankers. Like, what they're talking about to me isn't literature. They're talking about a job. And it's like, I get that it's a job, but it should be more. You know what I mean? It's a craft, too. Yeah. This is something we're chasing that is a little bigger than... And if I wanted a job, I'd have a job at the end of the day. And I don't. So I like to, chart my own course and fail on my own terms. And so far, it's worked out. It's been a perilous journey at certain times. I think it's made my publisher... it's probably given them ulcers. But it's, so far, it's worked.
When you made the decision to stop writing or to not continue with the series of the Patrick and Angie, genre fiction, and you moved into historical fiction.
Well, I did Mystic, and then I moved into historical.
Well, yes, absolutely. And that's was the perfect transitional thing. And then, interesting, then you did Shutter Island, which was like a totally different
thing. Yeah, totally different thing. Yeah.
But the historical novels.
My publisher loved that moment.
When you said when you fail, you get egg on your face, I'm trying to remember what you missed at, man.
I know. I personally know. I know, I hate almost everything I've written, but you should buy it. Don't trust me. You should buy it. But I remember, I'll give you an anecdote that was very telling for me. Gone Baby Gone, of the series of Patrick Kenzie books, it's the sort of universally acknowledged best of the series. And I've always felt strong about that book. And then when Ben Affleck was turned into a movie, we had dinner. And he started to show me all these pictures of people he was casting in the film. And he was like, and this is going to be Colin Earl, and this is going to be Roberta, and this is going to be... And gradually he started to read the look on my face, and he said, you have no idea who I'm talking about, do you? And I said, no. He said, you don't know your own characters. I was like, well, no. And he goes, you wrote the book. I was like, 8 years ago. I've moved on. And he goes, well, it's a really great book. You should check it out. And I said, okay, I will. And I went back to my house, and I pulled it off the shelf for the first time in 8 years. And I started to read it. And I was about 3 pages in, and I said, Lehane, how many prologues do you need? And how many times do you need to use 100 words to say what you could easily say in 10? And I just was like, this is crap. I don't believe I've sold this snake oil to anybody. And I put it on the shelf, and I've never looked at it again. And I think you should feel that way. If you're any good, you should feel that way. It's the people who are like, yeah, I'm pretty good. I can't hang with them. Yeah.
Do you find that you forget when you've written something? I mean, you just described that.
Some of it, yeah.
Exactly,
No, you remember some moments. Like
some moments.
I really hit that. I got that.
Yeah.
I remember, I remember for like Mystic River, I remember writing the first line of that book, which is one of the last lines that shows up in the book, which was, I remember sitting and getting it and running to a pad of paper and writing, it occurred to him while he was shaving that he was evil. Mm. And I drove the entire book towards that. It took 2 years. And then I remember. But the other day I was quoted, somebody sent me a quote. There's some website, some thing out there called Humans of New York. I have the book, but I don't know about the website. But I guess then somebody saw a picture on Humans of New York and then quoted me. Hmm. And I read the quote and I went, that's really good. I don't remember saying it. I don't remember writing it. Apparently I said it. And I was like, all right, I'll take that, you know,
very,
cool.
Very good, so. Very good. Well, now that you brought up Gone Baby Gone, we do have some clips. And so although this was an all-ages show, just like your
nobody
mother,
told me it was all-ages show, so I'm
yeah,
sorry.
And like his mother and father said, you're going to see a clip now from Gone Baby Gone. And if you're sensitive about your language, put your earplugs in now.
Planted evidence on a guy once. Back in 95, we were paying 108 bolt of snitches. We got a call from our pal Ray Lekansky. He couldn't find enough guys to rat out. Anyway, he tells us there's a guy pumping up an apartment up in Columbia Point. We go in, me and Nikki. 15 years ago, when Nikki went in, it was no joke. So it's a stash house, right? The old ladies beat the The husband's mean, cracked out, tries to give us trouble. Nikki lays him down. We're doing an inventory, but it looks like we messed up because there's no dope in the house. And I go in the back room. Now, this place was, mind you, rats, roaches all over the place. But the kid's room in the back was spotless. No, I mean, he swept it, mopped it. It was immaculate. The little boy sitting on the bed holding onto his PlayStation for dear life. There's no expression on his face. Tears streaming down. He wants to tell me he just learned his multiplication tables.
Yes.
I mean, the father's got him in this crack den, subsisting on Twinkies and ass whippings. And this little boy just wants someone to tell him that he's doing a good job.
You're worried what's Catholic?
I mean, kids forgive. Kids don't judge. Kids turn the other cheek. What do they get for it? So I went back out there. I put an ounce of heroin on the living room floor, and I sent the father on a ride, 7 to 9.
That was the right thing?
You gotta take a side. You molest a child. You beat a child. You're not on my side. If you see me coming, you better run because I'm going to lay you the down.
Okay. Good.
All right, so that's how weird this is. That was part of that is actually a true story. And I didn't even remember it.
Really?
I don't remember it until all of a sudden I saw it up there and I was like, oh, wow. I forgot I did do that, right? I wrote that in there. Yeah. The part about the kid cleaning the room is from when I was working in juvenile services. I was in a really bad house and it was just insanity. And all of a sudden, this little girl moved through the entire kitchen with cops everywhere, people screaming at each other and knives. It was insane. And this little girl just moved through the kitchen and she began to clean up. And I never forgot it. And somehow worked its way in there. Which I forgot, actually, it working its way in there. So, there you go.
How fortuitous.
Early Alzheimer's is awesome. Yeah.
But I think this clip also speaks to just what you were saying. I mean, you know, you go after these big issues and the moral quandaries and things in your stories, which are entertainments, of course.
Right.
But are about these major issues.
You're listening to author Dennis Lehane, whose latest book is World Gone By. He's joined in conversation by film noir expert Eddie Muller on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
This was also a good clip to select, I think, because you know, we had these people believing that you were just a complete do-nothing, beer-drinking lout until you found writing. But in fact, no. I mean, you had done a lot of work with
yeah.
children and
yep.
abused children and everything. And can you just give a little bit of your background on that and how that worked its way into your...
Yeah. It was two things I think I realized later on. You know, again, you realize these things, hopefully you realize them at some point, but I think most of the things we realize as adults is retroactive. I wasn't conscious of it at the time. But I went into, I was a therapeutic counselor with abused children, emotionally, physically, and sexually abused children. And I did that for a few years and never understood why I did it. I didn't know why I funneled that way in college and then after college. And then it was when I was writing Mystic River that I realized what it was. And Mystic River is a book in which I said, I'll never say the words, but I knew exactly what I was doing as I was writing it. The entire book's about survivor's guilt. It's the two main characters have survivor's guilt. And I said, they'll never say it, you know, Sean and Jimmy, but they're drowning in it. And they didn't get in the car. Their friend got in the car. His life was destroyed. They never got past it. So the reason I think I went into... working with kids is because I grew up in a neighborhood that was really poor, that was ravaged by poverty in a lot of ways, and all of the things that come with it, alcohol abuse, broken families, broken homes. In the midst of this insanity, and it was a very violent, dangerous, racially torn apart neighborhood, I lived in an extremely safe house. An extremely safe environment. I won the parental lottery. I had two immigrant parents, and they raised five kids on a working class guy's salary, and they weren't touchy feely. They weren't giving us. They weren't talking. You know, come home and tell us your feelings, son. And there was none of that. But they made you safe, and they made you feel there were expectations for you, and they made you feel like you were going to get out of here. You were going to get out of this world. And they were out of the world mm-hmm. that you were living in. And they had expectations, and they believed in education because my father had a seventh grade education and my mother had an eighth grade education. And they wanted us to do better. So when people say, you know, you grew up in 1980s Boston. I'm like, man, I grew up in 1940s Ireland. You know, I did. I really did. We went behind those doors, and it was not that world, you know. And you were, again, you were safe, and you knew what to expect. And so my friends, they weren't. And I have a lot of guilt connected to that. It's the only way I can put it. I was at a bar about 10 years ago at sort of a reunion with all of my friends that I grew up with, the ones who survived. And myself and another woman, who's still one of my closest friends, we've known each other since we were 9, we walked out and she said, it was so weird. 1 o'clock in the morning. Everybody was still doing the same shit. They were still scoring drugs from the same people. They had a litany of repeating exactly the things that had been done to them. And we're standing on the street and we're watching, you know, the cavalcade of cars and people screaming at each other. And I grew up in just a really loud neighborhood. And my friend turns to me and she goes, how come we made it? Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't know. I have no idea. You know, I do have an idea. It's my parents. But beyond that, I have no idea. And so that's why I went into working with kids, sort of a way of giving back. Mm-hmm. That's why I think I write about this stuff. I write a lot about, I didn't notice this till late in my career, but I write a lot about the concept of who's your true family. Is it your bloodline, or is it the people you choose?
Mm-hmm.
That shows up in my work a lot, and I think that comes from some of this,
right.
From forming really strong bonds with people when I was growing up. And I don't know. The other thing is Graham Greene said it. You know, you don't need to know what your obsessions are as a writer because you're just going to keep returning to them anyway, and they just keep showing back up in my books and in my they show up in everything. They show up in my screenplays. It's just the same central obsessions: the battle between the haves and the have-nots as a sort of a universal battle, the need for family, the end of innocence. I mean, all of these things just keep coming back.
Yeah. Yeah. So. It's interesting. We kind of first connected because of the noir thing.
Yeah.
And like, what is noir? And all this stuff. Dennis is quite an expert on the subject. But he had one of the best descriptions of it that I've come across, which was you've called it working class tragedy.
Yeah.
And the other thing, when people ask me, like, what do you think is the essential ingredient for a noir to be a noir, I always say it's empathy. Right? I mean, if the good writers make the audience empathize with the characters that are doing the wrong thing, because you feel like, oh, you know, I could definitely push this far. I could definitely see myself doing something stupid like that. And one of the best things that this man has ever written is a commencement speech. Your commencement speeches are fantastic because you make this point. You've very strongly made a point in one of those speeches about the difference between sympathy and empathy. And I think, obviously, you're in demand as a commencement speaker because of the very same qualities in working with kids. I think you speak directly to young people, you know, considering how we have managed to screw everything up so badly in this country right now.
Well, I think that, and I think that does speak to a lot of, I think that, you know, I don't think... I just think we are dangerously lacking in empathy in this country, dangerously, and I think there's a I just think there's this threat. I mean, you used to have. I mean, we get it. He was an idiot. His 15 minutes came and went, but there was a point where you had Glenn Beck going on the airwaves and talking to his wingnut followers and saying empathy is a bad word. And people were nodding.
Yeah.
Empathy is a bad word. It's a terrible word. I don't think you can... I'm sorry that if anybody ever says we're an empathetic country, I will just say 36-year-olds were mowed down in Sandy Hook and we still have the gun laws we have, the lack of gun laws we have. There's no empathy. Don't give me that, you know? we care about our myths. Mm-hmm. That's another central obsession of mine, I think, as I've grown older. America, and maybe every culture, but probably every culture, but America cares about its myths far more than its realities. How can you be walking around talking tough with a swagger about war when you're a draft dodger, like Dick Cheney or Donald Trump? And how can you be a bunch of people who avoided war going rah, rah, rah about draft dodgers? I mean, that's an essential disconnect that means you love the narrative more than you love the reality. And that just bothers me the most about this country. I think we're being dragged down by our myths, and we're just going to continue getting worse and worse and worse. There was no good time. I don't know how to break the news to the rest of the world, but there was no good time.
Yeah. We go back to those wonderful 1950s?
Yeah. That was a really great time to be white and male and sure to die of a heart attack. Yeah, you know, it's great. Let's have some more red meat and a pack of Luckies. I just think there was no good time. And the way I think about it is, I think of HUD a lot. I don't know why I think of that movie HUD. Mm-hmm. Remember HUD?
Yeah, Paul sure. Yeah.
And HUD is really about the father is the man who had to forge the empire. And to do that, he had to do very tough and difficult things. Yeah. And all the son got from him was the rigidness. Mm-hmm. And so then the son wants to embody what his father stood for, but he's missing the essential morality. And I see that over and over and over again. And what's sort of, in my opinion, dragging this country down is this, you know, well, in my father's day, you know what I mean? Like, you know, and please, you know, and so that's the other thing. I think the truest line I ever wrote about myself is in, it turns, I think it shows up in Live By Night. I wrote it for The Given Day, but then I saved it. Somebody says to Joe Coughlin, you see the best in the worst of people and the worst in the best of people. Hmm. And I think that's me in a nutshell. Hmm. If you tell me that I should not associate with that person over there because they're a drug dealer or whatever, I'll be like, really? What's he sell? Walk on over and chat with him. Yeah. And if you tell me, oh, that's a person, that person walking by you now in robes is worthy of your admiration, I'll be like, no, you've already lost me. Now you got to...
you really are Irish.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because what you're saying is, you know, we buy the narratives. We want to believe the narratives. So what is the responsibility of a storyteller? And why are we telling ourselves such stories these days?
I don't know. Because I think we're lost. I think we're just really lost. I think the world's just gotten really scary. And it's not just us. And believe me, it's not just us. The narratives that are going on in the rest of the world are terrifying. Yeah. That's one of the big things is I would go over to, I remember being in France once and they said, you Americans. And I said, whoa, stop, you know, because I'll start going, you French, you know. But I said, really, do you understand how ignorant that is to say you Americans? Because I was hearing it all the time in the aughts. You would get it all the time over there. And, you know, Eddie Izzard has a great thing. Just tell him you're Canadian. so you don't have to deal with the arguments all the time. And, But I said to this person, I said, do you understand that to say you Americans is as ignorant as saying you Europeans? It really is. That's how vast America is. Yeah, and to assume that I have anything more in common with somebody who's from Nebraska than, you know, as a guy from Boston it's kind of ignorant, you know, that you would have just as much in common being from France with somebody from Germany, you know. And then they said, well, you know, the racism, and I was like, the French are going to lecture me on racism? And I was like, really? And, you know, so you go down that path, which is that everybody, I don't think that America is unique in this regard. I think that we embrace our myths and we're being dragged down by our myths, just as I think so many other parts of the world are. You're seeing some really, what you see a lot is repression. I see repression of the self as one of the most dangerous things in the world. You look at the history of what did the 9/11 hijackers do just before they went to their heaven? They went to a strip club.
Yeah.
They went to a strip club. I mean, that to me is like if you can't get the paradox there, if you can't get the incredible hypocrisy of what you're doing, the day before you go and you kill a bunch of people because they don't stand up to your moral ideal, and you're going to a strip club, You need help. Clearly they need help. Yeah. I mean, that's an understatement.
Yeah.
But you see it over and over and over again. Repressed human beings. John Stewart's great line about when are we going to figure out that all of these people who are against gay marriage are gay? You know? I mean, it's as simple as that. You know, if you're getting all fired up about it, it's because I secretly think you hate a part of yourself that, you know.
And so, what is it that, because it's all fear-based,
yeah,
right? Fear-based. And what is it that everybody's so afraid of? I mean, we detoured into this. I hope you're with us on this.
But it's
kind of fascinating because, right, America's supposed to be the most fearless country ever in the history of the world. And obviously, we're just terrified of everything, it seems.
Everything.
And it's
everything.
Like, really, they're, like, wow.
They're coming for our guns. They're coming for our women. They're coming for our values. They're coming for our houses. They're coming for, you know, it's just like, you know, most people can't get out of bed in the morning to deal with this stuff. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know what it is. But I know that when I write that I go after myths. Mm-hmm. That Mystic River is the biggest anti-myth book I ever wrote. It's what I did was I took the noir hero, which is the guy the American crime fiction hero is basically the guy who, when society stops working, he says, I'm going to right the wrongs that society cannot or will not right. And I will go off as a vigilante, as a cowboy, as a knight, and I will fix this problem. And I did that with the Mystic River. And then I said, my big punchline was, what if he's wrong?
Yeah.
Let's have him do it. Let's have him do everything that he's supposed to do. Let's have him kill the bad guy. And then within an hour of killing the bad guy here, he wasn't the bad guy.
Yeah.
And it's because, you know, my thing was the myth is a dangerous myth. That's why we have courts of law. You know, crazy idea. Courts of law, Constitution, Bill of Rights, wacky theories. We're out there, you know, but that's what we're supposed to stand for. So, yeah, Geneva Convention, fun stuff like that.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get back to dames
and
guns.
Well, okay. Very briefly backstage, we were talking and touched on this. You did this trilogy of historical novels, The Given Day and Live by Night and World Gone By.
Yep.
And I wanted to ask this of Dennis before I realized that his new book is a contemporary book. Were you writing historical fiction because it was too tough to face the world today and you just didn't want to write it? I have this problem. I sit down to write fiction, and every time I'm drawn away from today because it's hard to face contemporary issues, and it's hard to write a thriller set in a modern day.
Yeah, it's a two-pronged
thing. With
cell phones.
Yep.
Yeah, cell phones have done a lot of damage to the thriller. That's why we were talking about how, you know, it's why the X-Files, like, nobody's phones ever malfunctioned more than Mulder's and Scully's. And it was, they were always sending them into the woods so that something wouldn't work, you know? And then we said there was a spate of sort of Arizona-based movies in the early 90s when the cell phones began, because they could always just, I remember Breakdown, which is a really cool movie, B-movie with Kurt Russell. And it was, you know, very early on in the movie, he had to be driving along and go, huh, my cell phone has no reception, you know, because yeah, it's great. Like when I was writing Shutter Island, that was one of the first decisions I made, was you got to set it before cell phones, because the plot ends the moment there's a cell phone. It's over. You can just pick up a cell phone and say, I'm at a mental institution on an island and you need to send somebody to get me before the hurricane hits, you know? Yeah, I think there's that. And then there was an issue of, I'm not a good political writer. I don't think my job is to be a political writer. I can be a political person, but my job is not to be a political writer. So I was so angry during the aughts that I kept thinking, if I write directly about what I'm angry about, it's going to be a soapbox books, and I don't want to write soapbox books. So I said, well, in my experience, the one thing I know about history is the more things change, the more they stay the same. So why don't you write about a time that seems to mirror our time? Mm-hmm. And that's when I picked post-World War I America, which was a really good mirror of 2000s America. It was almost identical. And then that just led me down the path. And I went down the path, and then when I was finishing World Gone By, I was like, man, I dream of a book in which somebody Googles. You know, that'd be cool. So I'm doing that now. I'm writing a contemporary. I'm just about to finish it about a marriage, actually. So, we'll
see. And it's called.
It's called Since We Fell, and it's about a woman. I've always wanted to write a Hitchcock. That was the desire. So I finally said I want to write. I had this image in my head of a woman. Who begins to believe she's borderline agoraphobic, and she begins to believe that her husband may have another life, a completely other life, you know, different wife, different kids, different everything. And so that becomes the driving engine of the book. She sees him at a point when he's supposed to be in another country. She thinks she sees him in the city.
And tell me this is set in Boston.
It's set in Boston.
I'm seeing this. You're going to do for Boston what Hitchcock did for San Francisco in Vertigo.
I'm trying to have a little fun. I'm not going to do that. Yeah, that's a tall order. Thank you. But it's set in Boston and Providence and parts of Maine.
So how is it, Dennis, that every other writer I know complains, who's been lucky enough to have their books turned into movies, complains that they always louse them up?
Yeah.
And you're like four for four, man.
I know.
It's incredible.
Well, I'll tell you my favorite story about all of this. After Gone Baby Gone came out, nobody saw Gone Baby Gone when it came out. Those of you who claim you did, you're lying. There was four people who saw it that weekend. I was one of them. but Gone Baby Gone picked up a reputation because there was a little known codicil in the FCC code that TNT had to show something once a week besides Shawshank Redemption. So they began to loop Gone Baby Gone in, and that's what built its reputation. We knew we had a great film. I mean, I knew when I saw it, I went, wow, this is Ben Affleck is born to be a director. This is a terrific film. But we also, it got blown out of the gate the weekend it opened. It was out of theaters within 3 weeks. But it was very well respected within the industry. So at that point, I was two for two. I'd had Mr. Gribber, I'd had Gone Baby Gone.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features author Dennis Lehane, whose latest book is World Gone By. He's joined in conversation by film noir expert Eddie Muller. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And then I get word on a Friday, I still remember I got word that Leonardo DiCaprio was interested in Shutter Island. And by Monday, Scorsese was in. And by Tuesday, it was leaking into the press. And I went out with my wife, and she said, "Who have you told?" And I said, "No one." She said, "What do you mean? I've told people in Italy." And she said, "Why would you tell no one?" I said, "I don't know. It's hard to explain. It's just, I feel guilty, you know?" And she said, "What are you talking about?" I said, I just feel like, you know, my friends are, you know, most of my friends who are writers, not only have they not had books, you know, turned into movies, but some of them haven't even had their books published. And I just don't know how to tell them. I just call them up. "Oh, by the way, Martin Scorsese is doing my film, you know?" And she was like, "You know, Dennis, they're going to find out. You know?" And I said, "I know, but I just can't see time." I just couldn't do it. I froze. It was like a paralysis. Went on for 2 days. I got an email from George Pelicano, who I work with on The Wire, and the subject line was Scorsese. And I clicked on the open, and all it said was, and that made me feel okay. So, it's crazy how lucky it's been. I mean, I take credit for one thing, and I do. It's not false modesty. I seem to write characters who actors want to play, good actors. So, okay, I take the credit there. But everything else, everybody says, "Well, you write good books." So did Fitzgerald, and they've Great Gatsby 3 times now. I mean, you know, it's not the book. It's I think it's the auteur theory, really. I think it's that Clint Eastwood and Brian Helgeland were left alone to do Mystic River, and Ben Affleck and Aaron Stockard were left alone to do Gone Baby Gone, and Martin Scorsese and Lita Calagritis were left alone to do Shutter Island. There was no studio interference after, you know, they sort of ponied up the money. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, and they ponied up the money that was commensurate with movies which had dark endings. It wasn't like they were overspending. Yeah. Well, they did on Shutter Island, but they had DiCaprio, so they made it back. There was a sense of art and commerce worked. Mm-hmm. And that's where I've been really lucky. The other thing is I don't sell to studios. Some people sell directly to studios, and then it's out of your hands. And then they can do anything they want. They can bring in any director. I've sold twice to producers whose work I admired very much. I sold Gone Baby Gone to Alan Ladd because Alan Ladd made Blade Runner. Blade Runner is probably my favorite movie. Mm. And I sold to Mike Medavoy for Shutter Island. And Mike Medavoy made like People vs. Larry Flint and Silence of the Lambs, and he worked on Apocalypse Now. I mean, so I got into bed, and I sold to Clint Eastwood. I got into bed with good people, and then I just figured, if you get into good with good people, the worst thing that's going to happen is an honorable failure. And I figure I'm due. I mean, you got to have you can't bat 1,000. So sooner or later, I'm going to have a movie that's not very good made of my books. But what I'm not going to have is the Demi Moore Scarlet Letter. That's what you fear. You know, that's really what you fear. You know, is everything but a car chase at the end. You know, you fear that they won't get the spirit of the. You know, I always use L.A. Confidential as a perfect example. L.A. Confidential, the book, and L.A. The Confidential, the movie, are very different. Yeah. They're extremely different, and yet the essence of both of them is identical. Mm-hmm. The essence. They got the essence of what he was trying to say. So who cares if they got the letter of the law? I mean, and you can appreciate both for what they are. So that's been my luck so far.
Well, that leads us to one more clip. We're going to show you one more clip. From, this is my favorite of the adaptations of your work.
Okay.
This is The Drop, which is based on a short story that Dennis wrote called Animal Rescue. That's a terrific story, and let's just show this clip, and then I'd love for you to talk about the transition.
Okay, because I don't feel bad about doing this, because I know none of you have seen this, so we're okay. All right, here we go.
but I know this guy. The moment I know him, I know him. Somebody robbed my bar.
Yes, that's right. Sorry, Mr. Umarov.
You call my father Mr. Umarov. Well, call me Chovka, eh?
Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry, Mr. Chovka. Somebody did rob your bar.
Who robbed our bar?
We don't know.
No.
They wore masks.
That's right. So we couldn't see.
Police report says one wore a broken watch. You tell them this?
Yeah, I did. I don't know. I wasn't thinking. It just came out.
So what have you done to get my father's money back?
Well, we put the word out.
Yeah.
In the neighborhood.
That's right.
They get the word out in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So the word is out there, huh? The word.
That's right.
Yeah.
With my money. Find my money, eh?
Find my money. If we knew where the money was, that would mean that we knew who robbed us, which would mean we were in on it, which means they would shoot us right in the face, these Chechens.
Chechens, Mon.
What?
They're Chechens. They're from Chechnya, but you call them Chechens?
Yeah, they're from Chechnya.
Yeah, I said that. But you don't call people from Ireland Irelandians, do you? So
what the f*** are you talking about?
Okay. Well, if this movie had come out after Mad Max, maybe. Tom
yeah,
Hardy,
yeah,
no. His appearance in this movie would have helped, perhaps.
We discovered something. Everybody involved in that movie, again, this is the same thing I'm talking about. We all grew up loving 1970s movies. Like, I could probably write a doctoral thesis on the French Connection, you know? So we all wanted to make the kind of movie Sidney Lumet would have made. Mm-hmm. So we all said, we're going to make a 1970s movie. Straight down the line, every single person in terms of the producers, the director, me, the actors, we all wanted to make it. And then opening weekend, we found out something which we maybe should have known, which is that most Americans don't care about 1970s movies. geeks like us do. But we made the movie we wanted to make. And that's what matters. That's truly all that matters. At the end of the day, we made it for a pretty low budget. So the studio has actually already earned their money back. So it's great. We didn't make, you know, we didn't make a big deal, but we made a movie that we're all real proud of. Mm-hmm. And Tom's proud of it, and Jimmy Gandolfini was really happy with his work. He died shortly after filming. And everybody involved, we just felt like we did something cool. We made Sidney, we looked up at the ghost of Sidney Lumet and said, we think Sidney would have liked this movie, yeah, you know, yeah. So.
It is a terrific film. And was that the first time that you had written the screenplay from?
It's the first time I've written from. I wrote it from a short story. I just felt like, yeah, I could extrapolate out, but I have a hard time compressing in on books.
Yeah.
You know. So.
Well, it was brilliant, actually. I mean, there's a theory that it's easier to write a good film from a short story than it is to take LA Confidential and
condense it down
into something manageable. So what happened with, I heard that you were adapting the John McDonald, the Deep Blue Goodbye. What happened with that? If there are any Travis McGee fans in the house.
Travis McGee fans in the house? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. I was asked to adapt the first book, which had gotten a very long and troubled history in Hollywood. And I did it. And we got a director and we got a star. And then we went to shoot. And then the star blew out his knee. It was Christian Bale. And so now it's back to, I don't know where. It's back to limbo. But here's the thing about writing movies versus in writing studio movies. I also have another studio movie in sort of some form of pre-production right now. As soon as I write them, I'm done. It is very much a job. That's the one part of this that I feel is a job. It's like, yeah, I've done what you asked. I hand it over. I've taken all your notes. I've incorporated them. Here's your script. And then I move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have any real connection beyond it, you know, beyond that. I would have a very different connection if I was directing, or if I was a very active producer. But when you're just the writer, you're just one of, you're one of like 170 people on a movie.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's really what you are. And they bring you in, and it's if it's the equivalent of building a house, they ask you to give you their plans, give you your plans. You know, give us the plans for this house. And you give it to them, and then they build it the way they want to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cool. That's the nature of the beast. You know, Donald Westlake had that great line about the difference between a screenwriter and a novelist. He said, a novelist is God, a screenwriter is God's tailor. Don't ask me why the tailor gets paid more than God, but that's just how it works out. You know? So.
Yes. Perfect. I think we're going to take some questions from the audience.
That'd be great.
I think we're going to do that. I hope people have some questions.
Yeah, I'm out of Dorchester also.
You're from Dorchester? Where?
Yeah.
From
the other side of Columbus Ave.
Okay.
And for those people who don't know the melting pot that never melted, Boston, Columbus Ave divided the Irish from the Jewish area.
That's right.
And it's interesting because...
And here we are, two Irish guys at the Jewish Community Center.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, very good.
I'm one of the
full
Jewish
circle
guys.
Of life.
Yeah. Esmond Street was actually where it was. Yeah, there's no... Italian or Jewish equivalent of you. Maybe it's the Irish storytelling gene. The question I have, though, is how do you select your historical novels, such as The Given Day, and how do you research them?
The Given Day was chosen because I can draw a direct line, which is really rare. In the mid-'80s, Reagan invoked Calvin Coolidge and the Boston police strike to fire the air traffic controllers and break the unions. And my father was a really proud union guy. And he didn't like that. And I remember being at the dinner table, and then I said, "Dad, what was the Boston police strike?" You know? And he said, "Well, the Boston police walked off the job." And I said, "When did that happen?" He said, "The 40s. You know, he didn't know. Made it up. So it was stuck in my head. And it just always stuck in my head. And then one day I was in a bookstore in New York, I think it was around 2000, and I saw a book about the Boston police strike, and I pulled it off the shelf, and I started to leaf through it, and I came across a story in which there was a cavalry charge down Beacon Hill in Boston. Bugles, the whole thing, like out of a John Ford film, but this was 1919. And I said, I couldn't get that image out of my head. And then I found a final fact, which was the Brahmins were so afraid that the natives, the Irish, were going to overthrow them, that they came up with, this is during the rioting, during the Boston police strike, that they came up with a really wonderful solution. They armed the Harvard football team. And it's true. And they sent the Harvard football team with rifles to the scene of some riots in South Boston. And the Harvard football team fired on the crowd, and they killed three people. And I said, I'm doing it now. You know, my class rage issues, I'm on it. So, and that's what drove the book. The research was, I spent a year researching everything about that time period, from November 1918 to January of 1920. And it was the biggest waste of time of my life. It was. It truly is. For any of you who are writers and ever thinking of doing research, this is why I'll tell you it's a waste of time. I used about maybe 4% of it in the ultimate book. I am now a walking encyclopedia or expert on 18 months in the history of the United States, actually of the globe, that nobody cares about. I can think of no place where I can use it at a cocktail party. You know, did you know what happened in Bavaria in January of 1920? There's no place to slide that stuff in. So unless I get on Jeopardy, and it happens to be a category, it was a year of my life I can't get back. The best way to do research, to me, is as needed. You write along, and then you need something like, I own a bunch of Sears catalogs now from the 1920s. So what were they wearing? Sears catalog. What kind of stoves did people have? Sears catalog. What kind of rifles did they have? Sears catalog. It's amazing. And then... other things, what was the price of a movie? You can look up. What would people smoke? You can look it up. It's you do it as you need it. And that's a much more wonderful way to do it.
Hi, thank you.
Hi. Thanks.
Do you have any books that you read on the craft of writing, and do you believe in the formula for the screenplay, or are you writing with regard to like thinking about how it's going to translate?
Yeah, I think you can. I think all of that stuff is helpful. I'm not dogmatic about any of it. Look, here's how I write, and it's probably not helpful. I don't recommend doing what I do, because let's put it this way: I started with a group of people. What I consider my homeroom class. S.J. Rosen, Laura Lippman, Michael Conley, Lee Childs, Harlan Coben, George Pelicanos. Every single one of those writers has double my output. They've all written about 24 novels since we all started together. I've written 12. My method is not the one to trust because I can't produce a book a year. I can't do it. I've tried. It's disastrous. I've aborted books. I've had books fall apart on me. Mystic River, I wrote 150 pages in the wrong direction. I had to go back. I had to tear out the center of the book. Live by Night, I finished a draft. I realized I'd completely f*** an entire storyline. I had to rip out the center of it and do it all over again. That's what comes from my method. And my method is essentially no method. I usually know a couple of big things. I know one thing to get me started. Let's say it's the alphabet. I know A, I know M, and I know X. I know one thing in the middle, which usually changes, and I know one thing at the end. And everything else is just, I don't know, it's like trying to drive a car with bald tires across an infinite lake, frozen lake, you know, toward a train track. And then you hit the train track in Act 3, usually. The other analogy I have is a roller coaster, and I'm in it right now. I'm finishing Since We Fell. It's all now just, it's just follow all setup. It's all downhill now. It's like, okay, now she's outside the door. Okay, the next chapter, she's going to drive to here. Because I know it's coming to the end. It's coming to the end. So now I feel like I'm on tracks. But for the first year of writing the book, I was spinning across the lake. E.L. Doctorow said it's like driving on a pitch black night with your headlights on, and you can only see as far as your headlights can see. But somehow that's how we finish journeys. Thank you very much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was author Dennis Lehane, whose latest book is World Gone By. He was joined in conversation by film noir expert and writer Eddie Muller. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.